Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Kathy Bessant to the broadcast. Kathy's a global technology and operations executive at Bank of America and a member of the company's executive management team. Since 2010, Kathy's been responsible for delivering end-to-end technology and operating services across the company through a team of nearly 100,000 employees and contractors in 35 countries around the world. Global Technology and Operations provides the platforms and fulfillment services that sustain the company's consumer banking, wealth management, commercial banking, treasury services, sales and trading, and investment banking business, as well as risk management, finance, and other critical support functions. Kathy's team also oversees the company's business continuity and information security strategies and policies. Kathy currently chairs the board of directors of Foundations for the Carolinas, one of the largest community foundations in the United States. She's also the lead director for Florida Blue, formerly Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida, and is a member of the Board of Trustees for the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Kathy was named to American Banker's 25 Most Powerful Women in Banking list in 2013 for the third consecutive year, and she was also honored as one of Computer World's 2013 Premier 100 IT Leaders. I recently caught up with Kathy in the Bank of America offices in New York City, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed Kathy's approach to grooming future leaders, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed the way in which she sees IT woven into the broader organization at B of A, as well as her description of her involvement in board work, in addition to a variety of other topics. Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Kathy Bessant, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be here.
Kathy, I thought we'd begin with your role. You run what's referred to as Global Technology and Operations here at Bank of America. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the groups that report into you and the sort of purview that you have within that role.
Sure. Five CIOs that are responsible for each of our lines of business as well as for risk and finance report into me. Those CIOs manage for their businesses all of the technology and all of the operations, everything from, you know, cash vault processing, nickels, dimes, quarters, the actual physical movement of money, to obviously the most sophisticated technological movements that we make. I also have responsibility, of course, for infrastructure, for information security, and for business continuity. So run those on behalf of the total company.
And with so many different areas of responsibility and actually multiple CIOs, as you pointed out, how do you coordinate those efforts? Obviously, the application of technology will vary based upon where it's being applied. But how do you think about your role as influencer from the center, so to speak, and pushing standards where appropriately versus those instances where one-off solutions or one-off processes might be appropriate?
I think balance is probably the most important word or theme. You know, we're lucky. We start with a company and a CEO who believes in a unified vision. So while we run separate segments or lines of business, he does put all of us through the rigor of a unifying focus to the work that we do. So we all use the same set of operating principles, the same set of goals and objectives at the highest level. And that makes the unification of the technology and operating functions both clear, but also important. Because I think if you were to ask our management team, one of the things and functions that we play that's most important is that of glue, taking pieces that could otherwise be disparate and making sure that they support a unified, integrated company vision. You know, the whole idea is to put the full breadth of the company to work in every single client moment that we've got. And then that means that everything from the front office sales moment to the back office servicing and fulfillment has to work in unison, regardless of the part of the company that is engaged. And so I think it takes balance. I think it takes, and what we've tried to build is a talent pool that sees both the line of business role, the functional role of technology, and the unification of the client experience very seriously. So it's all about talent. And then there's a little bit of sheer will, right? A little bit of cajoling on a good day and coercion on others. And actually, in a field like technology, that's what you want to see. I want highly intellectual, highly energized, very passionate people directed towards solving the business problems of the company. And so the occasional coercion to keep it unified, to me, that's the appropriate price of having great talent.
As you think about the plans that each of the different parts of your organization have, can you talk a bit about some of the common themes that have emerged from across those organizations? What are some of the priorities as you look forward a year or two or three?
Sure. We're really at a great point in time at the bank. We've spent our last 3.5 years really focused on the things that you would expect for a company that's coming out of a period of rapid acquisitions over a long period of time and emerging from a global financial crisis. So we've been focused, no matter what part of my organization, focused on the reduction of risk, focused on simplifying and modernizing what we do. So taking the unfinished work of all of those transitions and acquisitions and bringing the platforms and systems and capabilities to target state. We've been focused on reducing operating costs. Margins in the banking business are forever changed, and as a result, bringing revenue to the bottom line depends on a very keen eye toward expense management. I'm careful here not to think about it as pure expense reduction. You can't grow, you cannot underspend your way to growth, but it is about spending where there's value creation and being massively efficient where clients aren't interested or can't or won't pay. And then the last thing we've been really focused on, and it's not last in terms of the marketplace, but the other thing we've been focused on is bringing world-class capabilities to market, notwithstanding all the other headwinds the company has faced. So, you know, progress in mobile banking, progress in data, progress in really features and functions that make us magnetic to clients. All of that has to be delivered at the same time you're reducing risk, simplifying the place, and getting unnecessary cost out.
You mentioned a moment ago, Kathy, that the importance of having members of the IT team writ large who are embedded within the businesses that they're supporting and understanding the plans they have and the priorities and perhaps by extension also the customers that each of them serve.
Right.
This has been a traditional challenge of a lot of IT departments, which historically, and I'm painting with a broad brushstroke, but are rather insular perhaps, not necessarily as cognizant of the needs of end customers. How do you think about how the roles of IT leaders have changed and that the need to be much more business savvy as opposed to simply being great technologists? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I don't come from a classic technology background. One thing that I found most surprising when I came into this role was the number of people, not so much in our firm, but other places, who would say, we like technology as a black box. We like to cajole the business to invest, and we deliver magical things on the other end. And that notion of technology as separate from the business, I think, isn't only suboptimal. I think it's really destructive. I think it's why you see rapid turnover in positions like mine, because ultimately businesses don't bet on magic. Businesses bet on technologists and capabilities that solve business problems, that serve customers brilliantly, and that make the internal workings of a company easier. And so I think the role of the technologist has changed light years in the last 10 years, and certainly the last 4 or 5 years where I've been paying particularly keen attention. But, you know, gone are the days of hiring someone at my level or two or three deep into my organization for their ability to write code, right? It is the ability to identify and understand a business problem and apply technology as the solution, not technology as a destination to itself.
You mentioned a moment ago that you are not somebody who grew up in technology. You're rather an autodidact who, I assume, has sort of learned as you've mm-hmm. gone on in your career, learned more about technology and its power, as opposed to somebody who began with an engineering degree and grew up within an IT department. Can you talk a bit about that learning process for you and the process that you went to and perhaps continued to go through in being the technologist second, so to speak, and a business leader first, but how you've gone about kind of feeding your own curiosity and your own learning process as an IT executive?
Well, I think, first of all, the key for anybody who comes into a functional role, whether it's marketing or technology or finance, from a business, a more general business background, the key to that is embracing the need to learn and not being sorry about the need to learn. There's an immediate benefit to having a business background, no matter what role, functional role, someone takes on. So leveraging that immediate benefit and then finding both formal and informal ways to learn, I think, is what it's all about. So for me, it's been having a voracious appetite to figure it out, a constant willingness to probe and say, I don't know, when I didn't know, and also finding safe places to learn, so that sometimes learning can't happen in the environment in which later you'll be making a decision. Sometimes you have to walk into the decision-making moment having learned somewhere else. So building peer relationships in the industry, learning from our third parties who are our strategic vendors and partners, really just finding any source that's applicable to the moment, being completely open and not apologetic about the need to learn, confident that there's a business benefit from having the general business background, and then applying all of those things together. It is a little bit also about the composition of the team, right? There is a viewpoint among some technologists that only code writers can supervise code writers. And I think that may be true in some levels of an organization that is of my size. But by the time you get to reporting to someone at my level or reporting to one of my direct reports, your business and analytical skills are far more important than your ability to deliver a specific application or line of code.
Now, actually, referring to the roles you've had, and I'm not sure it's a complete list across your 31 years at the bank, but you have been, among other things, perhaps, the president of global corporate banking, the president of the bank's global treasury services, the global product solutions group. You're even a chief marketing officer at one point. And now, of course, you have the set of responsibilities that you described at the outset of our interview. And I find it so interesting the number of hats and experiences that you've had within this organization. And I can only imagine, again, getting back to perhaps the autodidactical nature of of your own professional experience, the areas of responsibility that you've had that have traditionally been very different from each other, just to take the CMO and the technology roles as examples, for instance. Can you talk about how you managed your career and how you have either sought opportunities or found them, sought the counsel of others to determine where to go next and where your services might be needed?
Well, one of the unique elements of Bank of America and the way it's grown has meant that over time, when you grow by acquisition, that is chunky growth. So all of a sudden you're one size, and the next day you're twice the size you were the day before. And so career opportunities and stretch assignments are just the nature of the beast when a company grows that way. So I've been blessed to have a lot of opportunities and to have a piece of that career management handled more by the company and pulled into jobs than my pushing into jobs. You know, I'd say the skill sets that translate across all of those roles, certainly the need for business and analytical acumen, all of the classic things, but probably more than anything else, I've over time built a knowledge base around fixing things, around taking the situation at hand, being able to assess it, see both strengths and gaps, and then be fearless about pursuit of solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm joking, I say that I still need therapy for my years as chief marketing officer because I'd always grown up right in the lines of business. And to take a person who runs a P&L and say you're responsible for marketing is almost a disconnect in a career of epic proportion. And I probably spent the first 6 months of that bewildered and confused and unclear myself about the dichotomy in successive assignments. Eventually I figured it out, but I think that preparation, having then gone back into the products and businesses of the company, and then the assignment to run technology and operations, that preparation in marketing actually made the assimilation and the development of knowledge much quicker and much more directed once I came into the technology role.
There's so much that's written these days, Kathy, about the need for the CMO and the CIO, or at least the marketing and IT organizations, to collaborate a great deal more. And there's been a lot of pontification as to, you know, almost a rivalry between these organizations. Gartner has said that by 2017, marketing is going to be responsible for more of the IT budget than the CIO will. The CMO will be over the CIO, just to take one provocative in a set of assessments. But I wonder, having held responsibilities at the highest level within a technology organization, as well as having been CMO, what insights do you have about the intersection between IT and marketing, the value of those that happens at the nexus of those two disciplines, and moreover, the opportunity to take these disciplines that are so different historically and stereotypically and make them sing together a little bit more than they have?
Well, a couple of observations. One is they're more similar sometimes than people think. They are both means to an end. They are both means of taking what a company does and getting it to customers, right? And having those customers be delighted, and then measuring that feedback and repeating the cycle. So whether it's the use of marketing techniques to create demand for products or the use of technology to deliver them, again, starts with the need of the business and ends with the client, or actually starts with the client, determining the needs of the business and ending with the client. So I have found a tremendous amount of similarity. I would say that, and maybe this is pedantic, but competition between a CMO and a CIO is dysfunctional. It's not optimal and completely unnecessary, in my view. It has nothing to do with the personality. What business needs, let's just take data as an example. Business needs the brilliant manufacturing of data, data that is well organized, efficient to manage and store, can be delivered on a timely, accurate, comprehensive basis. That's the job of the CIO, and it is not easy. Anybody who sits in the chair knows, really tough job. The job of the CMO is utilization, taking the data and actually causing it to mean something, getting insights from it that, absent the work of the technologist, wouldn't be possible. Right? You know, I've been in roles, all of us have, where you've been information bound almost. There's so much information available that the ability to distill it is actually more important than the ability to create it. But I see a real, you would really describe this to me, I would describe this as complementary angles, not supplementary angles, to go back to my theory that life is all about geometry anyway, but complementary angles, because one can't exist without the other. Where there's overlap, smart people can figure that out, because I would consider that an anomaly. But there is a coexistence there that is a real powerhouse when it comes to enabling companies to be brilliant for their customers and clients.
You are an executive who's now on the board of a number of other organizations, and that this is a great aspiration. Again, you don't have a goal technology background, but I know that a lot of CIOs aspire to become board level. But it's been a role within the corporate structure where that invitation has often eluded them, and there are a variety of reasons people have given. Part of it is the lack of traditional P&L responsibilities as they've grown up in their departments, for instance, or perhaps spending a great deal of their career in organizations that have tended to be more reactive and order-taking as opposed to proactive and strategic. And obviously these are the sorts of mindsets one needs when they're serving on a board and advising a company. I have a couple of questions there. One is, what you have drawn from your experience having counseled a number of companies now at the board level, as well as what advice would you offer to CIOs and IT executives who aspire to become board level as to the kinds of experiences they ought to accrue in order to become attractive to potential companies in that manner?
Well, I start from a pretty simple premise, which is that corporate board service, or sophisticated not-for-profit service, but let's stick to corporate boards for a moment. Corporate board service is a must for anyone who wants to be a senior level executive in a large corporation. And the reasons for that are, I think, many. One is the breadth of experience, especially if that board experience is in a sector outside of the sector in which the person operates. For me, one of my corporate boards is healthcare, similar in some ways to financial services, but not identical. And so the breadth of learning and expansion of thinking has been very helpful to my work. I think the second reason board service is important is that it tends to smooth the ups and downs that happen in any career and in any company. You know, there are moments where you feel great about what you're doing if you're telling the truth in your firm, and moments where you wonder if the world loves you or actually truly does hate you. You can't be part of corporate America and not have both of those and everything in between. The thing I have found about board service is that because boards work to create a peer-based, collegial environment where all viewpoints are honored and respected, that element of respect and desire for opinion and pull for opinion creates a sense of value and a sense of contribution where sometimes careers can be up and down in that regard. So I can give you a million reasons why I think board service is important, but I would encourage anyone, any CIO who thinks it's important, that A, they're right, and B, they should go for it. Now, what I think it takes, I do think it takes more than a classic technology perspective. It doesn't have to be manifested in roles. In other words, it doesn't have to be manifested in actually running a P&L, but it does have to be demonstrable in the interview or evaluation process that boards go through. So I think being well-rounded, having a broad skill set, and able to speak the language of business is incredibly important, regardless, by the way, of the functional discipline that somebody comes from. I think the second thing that's important is to develop a skill set around working as a peer versus working in an organization that has a hierarchy. Those are very different experiences, and the ability to gain alignment, to gain a consensus, to develop to the point of getting a vote to go the right way, or the way that it should and supposed to go in the best interest of the company. Those things are easy if you're the boss and you sign someone's paycheck and there's only one viewpoint that matters. On a board, building peer relationships that move the work of the company forward and doing that in a horizontal environment versus a hierarchical environment and building those skill sets in advance, hugely important. The other thing I think is true specifically for CIOs is that a lot of times I find that my most brilliant technologists consider the development of other parts of their professional lives to be extracurricular. In other words, they would focus 150% of their attention and passion on technology and technology delivering, like we said earlier, for customers and in the best interest of the firm. That is, in fact, the job of a CIO. It is not the role a CIO can play, and that unwillingness to devote time to things that some technologists see as extracurricular will get in the way of board service. I am convicted about this. My board service has made me better at what I do. I feel the same way, by the way, about parenting, the same way about my work around diversity and inclusion, the same way about all of my civic, not necessarily my corporate board, but my civic experience in addition to my corporate board experience. They've all made me better at what I do. And so I would encourage the classically trained CIO who wants board experience to understand that it takes the investment of time and that that time is not only worthy in terms of getting the board seat, it's also worthy in terms of making you better at what you do.
You mentioned your pride in having partaken in various activities that have strengthened the diversity of the organizations that you've served. You know, it struck me that in your current role, in your current company, you operate in two different fields that have not traditionally been the domain of females, that is finance and technology. And I wonder, obviously the technology aspect of that in your own career was a more recent development, but you've been in financial services for quite some time. And thankfully, I hope you would agree, there are more role models perhaps for the young woman who joins a financial services organization or businesses generally today than perhaps when you did. But I wonder if you could reflect on your early days and who your role models were, and likewise, now that you're certainly in a position to be a role model for others, how you've reflected upon that change and sort of paid it back in light of some of the learnings that you've had.
For me, the way I got started in financial services is because it wasn't sales. Coming out of business school, I had a degree in finance and a degree in marketing, sort of a joint degree, but I knew I did not want to do hardcore sales. What I wanted was something that could combine analytics and problem solving with marketing. And so what could be better than what I did at the time, which was corporate and commercial banking, where you're making capital and balance sheet recommendations and pitches, and at the same time, client calls and client meetings, where bringing the firm to market, i.e. marketing, is what it's all about. So I chose financial services deliberately, and I chose it a bit naively. I didn't realize it wasn't the purview of women, and that speaks a lot to how I grew up. My mother worked almost the whole time I was growing up. I actually grew up in a household where I never knew that there was a man's world or a woman's world. And so I probably spent the first 5 years of my career blind to the notion that I was the only woman in most of the rooms I was sitting in. That's sort of a benefit, actually, because it keeps the focus on the work. That said, it is a very naive view, and certainly was 30 years ago when I joined the company. When I think about role models, I think there are things to be learned from almost every person that I've ever worked with or worked for. I think there are things to be learned not to do as well. My approach to it has always been pick what's great and what would work for me about the experiences of other people that I've had and apply them and observe the things that don't work so well or work incredibly badly and try not to do them. If you had to push me for role models, you know, for me, the person that wraps it all up is Hugh McCall. Not unusual in our company. Maybe unusual to your question because he's a man, but he's an individual who's always had that balance of incredible analytical skill with really sharpened people and intuitive skills, a fearlessness about attacking the issue at hand, and yet at the same time, a soft side or a human side that allows him to get the very best of people and to be an outstanding leader. So if I had to, you know, be pushed to have one, I would say Hugh McCall, because he represents to me the total picture, but learned a lot of skills and a lot of things not to do from a lot of other people as well.
And how do you think about it now as others seek your counsel?
I tell them the same thing. I always try to keep the conversation about work. I'm happy to talk about balance. I'm happy to talk about anybody's individual issues. But in a real mentoring setting or role model setting, I find the best field on which to have those conversations is to look at a business problem, talk about the actual answer, how to get that answer to be bought into by the rest of the company. Because every single situation you would encounter in business and need to understand how to be mentored or role modeled for happens in that process. The way I think about it really is to talk about things that have gone well and experiences I've had, but to be most open and try to be most forthright about things that haven't gone well. The moments where there have been setbacks, a business review that's gone horribly, the moments where I've been demoted. It's happened to me at least once in my career, because people can generally find their way through the positive opportunities. It's how to understand that you're successful because of your setbacks and not in spite of them that is the place where I'm most comfortable adding value. So I try to be honest about it and real, try to be direct. I do take it very seriously. I sponsor aggressively our Women in Technology organization in the bank. I'm the executive sponsor for our lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender network in the company. So I try to look for those role modeling opportunities in a wide variety of places and take the role very seriously, customize it for the individual, but be most open and forthright about the times it hasn't gone well.
It's striking, Kathy, it seems like a theme that has been running through our conversation is the balance you have in being humble enough to understand when you don't know something or where there's a weakness to be filled in or where there's an opportunity to seek the counsel of somebody who, by virtue of their experience, knows more than you, while also all the way along recognizing how you can leverage your past experiences creatively in new environments, new roles, new responsibilities, whether it's the extraordinary path that you've taken through B of A to your current role, whether it's drawing learnings from the outside with the boards that you are serving on to make you a better bank executive while also being a good counselor to those businesses, some of which are very different from your own. I think it seems like it strikes me as a very admirable quality. Leads me actually to another question that I wanted to ask. In doing some homework on in preparation for this conversation, I found out that you are very passionate about reading and passionate about Shakespeare. And these are certainly not necessarily the average other section of the CV for technology people. But now that I've gotten to know you a little bit and hear a little bit more about your story, I'm not necessarily so surprised that your intellectual appetite is at least as diverse as the experiences that you've had. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. I don't know that there's necessarily a bearing on your professional life, but I'd love to hear you talk about it a bit.
Well, I try to use the bearing to the positive. I try not to say if someone hasn't spelled a word right or used proper grammar that they're completely useless to me as an executive. I will admit occasionally to those moments, but I try not to make that a universal. Interestingly, I believe that there's a lot of symmetry between English and technology. It's all about language, actually, and it's about translation. Translation from technical terms to business terms. Translation of technical outcomes to business outcomes and vice versa. Business needs to technical requirements. In many cases, especially in an organization that's the size of the one that I'm lucky enough to run, It's about the ability to create a vision, yes, but more importantly, to communicate it. And to communicate it sometimes in a language that is sophisticated and complex and engages highly complex thinkers, but in some cases, to make that vision engaging and meaningful to people who serve customers and clients in our most important and most basic functions every day. So I find a lot of similarities. I also like allegory. So the great thing about English to me has always, and my reading to me has always been, gives me ample opportunity for allegory. And allegory is a great way to solve a business problem, regardless of where that allegorical reference comes from, right? It doesn't always have to come from reading Jim Collins. It can come from figuring out what Hamlet was thinking. It can come from really a wide variety of sources. And so those allegories, for me, it also comes from sports. I'm an avid sports fan and sports spectator. My children are great athletes. I say that's not genetic, to be clear. Definitely not genetic. But lots of sports allegories. It's just that those are more typically used. And it won't surprise you, having talked to me for a few minutes, that I like the things that aren't typically used. So I'd rather give you a Shakespeare analogy than I would a sports analogy, but the application is the same.
Just one final question. You mentioned sports, and we've already talked about those organizations, these boards you serve on. One is the NASCAR Hall of Fame, which I was very intrigued by. Speaking of the domain that one wouldn't necessarily think to be stereotypically female, I'm curious about how you became involved and a bit about it, what you can share at least about the sort of vision that that organization has and your contribution to it.
Well, a couple of things. Regardless of whether it comes across, and I secretly hope it doesn't, I am a complete and total geek. And so the engineering element of the sport and the real precision that it takes to do everything from make a car go fast to perform a pit stop in under 15 seconds, those things are immensely intellectually compelling to me. I come from a passion for it, very honestly. I used to clean rows 1 and 2 at Michigan International Speedway when I was 14 years old.
Wow.
It was both a way to get to watch the race for free, but also a way to earn money, you know, growing up in a family with two teachers, two public school teachers and four kids. So I love racing, and I do so because I've been watching it since I was 14 years old and cleaning up after it since I was 14 years old. And what better application of a career and a civic passion than to be part of the bid process to win the NASCAR Hall of Fame? So a sport I know and love, a city I know and love, an ability to put a pretty complicated financial transaction together, and then to be part of a great team to help sell it into the community. It's just the culmination for me of a lot of great things. You know, you said something to me earlier that really struck a chord with me and made me want to share something with you. One realization I've had throughout my career is that, setting my 14-year-old experience at Michigan International Speedway aside, my first real get a paycheck, not a weekend kind of thing, was McDonald's. Like, I think 20% of America actually has some sort of fast food experience in their background. But I happened to work for a fabulous McDonald's franchisee. Two things. One is constant motto: if you've got time to lean, you've got time to clean. And so thriving in that environment and learning that in my very first job ever has been a constant refrain for me in terms of seeking out the next thing, finding things that seem to be running well, and creating a burning platform to make them better. Those values were instilled in me at a very young age. The other thing is, I liked working at McDonald's. I am not flippant about my career at all. I love my career. I love what I do. But I start every day with the foundational knowledge that I loved working at McDonald's. And if that's what I, that there are lots of things people can love and have meaningful careers in doing. And if this one isn't the right fit for me, there are other careers that are. To be at that point is probably something, and to have that understanding is probably something I'm capable of in my 50s that I certainly wouldn't have been capable of in my 30s. When all I wanted was the next job and the next promotion and the next big assignment, and please give me the bigger account, and how am I going to report one level above? There's a truth to the fact that wisdom is wasted on old people, but it's why I'm so passionate about talent and building the future. That was sort of a long ramble, but there's a little bit of, you know, honestly, rarely do I find someone that actually asks the questions about the how as much as the what. And really, I've been very fortunate in that the how in me was instilled almost without me knowing it, and not necessarily in the context of having grown up in a family of business executives. I took my daughter on her campus visits, and she wanted to see the business school at all the business at all the schools we went to, which shocked me. And every meeting we went into, she said, someone would say, "Why are you interested in business?" And she would say, "Well, look at my mom." I thought, "Wow, who knew you were paying attention?" You know? But she will have a different sense of what business is than I ever did. I'm just lucky that. I'm very fortunate to have been led from the time I was 14 very well.
Kathy Bisson, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a wonderful conversation. There's so much that I think a wide array of technology executives can draw from your experience, your diverse experiences, but also the extent to which you can reflect so well on what has worked, what you've learned from, who you've learned from. So I really appreciate you taking this time and sharing your insights.
Well, it all comes from good questions, actually, Peter. So no kidding aside, thank you. Great questions, great discussion.
Much appreciated.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the value of a connected ecosystem to inspire innovation for tomorrow. To learn more, visit redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.